Good evening and Merry Christmas, everybody. This is December 23rd, 2021. James McKenna here with my Science Hour and many topics to cover tonight. You know, and there may be people out there listening to this show that have never heard it before because they're visiting somebody that's an avid listener, have been for years. This show is in its second, going into its third decade. One of the longest running radio shows around, really. I mean, if you look at all of the people that you listen to today, very few, I could name off a few that are still out there that were back in the day at that time, but I'm not going to name names here, but lots of people have come and gone in the radio world, and this show is still here, weekly, one day a week, Thursday evening, the exact same time, the exact same frequency, the exact same station, WWCR Nashville, Tennessee, Tower Number 2, and all the different frequencies, the different ways to listen are listed on my webpage. But welcome, everybody, and Merry Christmas very much, and I hope you're going to have a truly happy new year, and welcome in 2022, which I do hope is a bit better than this year. I commented last week, I said, you know, 2021 might be one of the worst years in history, if that's even possible. But no, I mean, there were lots of bad years and lots of bad, incredibly bad things going on in the world, other years going throughout history. So, and also it's a personal thing. Some people, things went very well. In fact, an odd thing is my business usually picks up when disaster strikes. I'm in the, you know, water filter business, selling whole house and water filter element replacements, etc. And people tend to think about those things more when times are tough. And the reason is they go, gee, you know, I better get my act together. When everything is going good, everybody's, you know, buying Barbie dolls and drones and things like that. But when things are not going good, then people start to think about, doggone it, you know, the anyway, that's just a commentary on the mentality of people. When things are going good, you know, they don't think about the future, the problems, etc., that you might run into. But anyway, tonight I'm going to talk about some a little bit about the Christmas comet, and I think I should start with that and with the Merry Christmas message. Just state that, remember, Christmas is about the birth of a little baby thousands of years ago in a manger, probably a little bit of snow on the desert that night, out in the middle of nowhere, a little town called Bethlehem. And overhead, now for months prior to this event, there were three kings, leaders of countries, and they came from the east. They were wearing Eastern garb, etc., and they had followed this star for months. Months, mind you, not days or weeks, or didn't jump in the Ferrari and drive across the highway on the desert. No, these guys came by camel. So to prepare and to mount their expedition to take all the things they needed, not to mention the gifts that they knew that they were going to be giving to this child, and then to arrive at the time when the child was born, they had to be traveling before the baby was born. And so what their key was a signal in the heavens. And it was something so unusual that it would have been thousands of years, something so unusual that it would not have any duplicate astronomically for thousands of years. And so what could that have been? And clearly it was a comet. And it's amazing the atheist scientists that are out there that believe that there's no God, there's no design to the universe, etc. They want to tell you around Christmas time that the Christmas star was a planetary alignment. That's one of their favorite lies. And a planetary alignment, first of all, happens, we have probably two or three or four every year. So it's not an unusual event. Even an alignment of major planets probably occurs every 10, 15 years. Certainly not a rare event, something that happens thousands of years, etc. And also, the biggest issue is that planetary alignment only lasts for a couple hours, you know, at most a day, and then it's gone. And so it's not something that three guys would buckle up and put all their stuff and their all of their attaches and assistants into a camel train and start walking for the period of better part of a year. Because it took them, I made some calculations one time, you know, traveling a conservative or a liberal, I guess, 15 miles per day, and knowing where they came from, the Far East, coming to Bethlehem, which is near the Mediterranean, it took them months and months of travel. And so, it would have taken quite a bit of time just to pack up and leave. But they were so intent on seeing this baby being born, and remember that they got, along the way, they stopped and Herod talked to them and said, and Herod was aware of this too. Herod's astrologers, as they called them at the time, saw this also and knew that the sign was in the heaven, and he told the three wise men, who by this time had grouped up, had found one another on the route coming to the west. And the curious thing about this star, this Christmas star, if you listen closely to the legends and the stories, is that they were discovered in the east. Now, these guys were in the east, so it was discovered in the east, but they followed it to the west. So what happened here? This comet crossed behind the sun or between us and the sun and became an evening star in the west. And so they discovered it in the east, shining brightly in the east, remember the story, but they followed it to the west. So this is another indication, clear indication, that this was a comet, not a planetary alignment. Okay, so anyway, but those astronomers work for the New World Order, they get their paycheck, and they got to say something, and they're atheists. They don't have any value, even though they study the universe. They study the universe and a creation that they don't understand. They're just discovering little bits and pieces of it. And they don't realize that this universe existed long, long ago and it's going to exist long into the future. And I can't believe that people who look at this from a scientific... Scientists should be the first people who should realize that there's a grand design. Because you look at a carbon atom on the far side of the universe or a diamond or a tree or... whatever, because sure, there's going to be trees out there. They may not look like oak and pine trees, but there are variations. And sure, there's going to be life out there. And this grand design, and in fact, I was going to say that the Webb telescope right now, the James Webb telescope, is going up into outer space now, and it's going to see farther than any telescope that's ever been built before. And I remember when they built the Hubble, they said the same thing, that this is going to see to the edge of the universe. In other words, they're going to look out to a certain point and there's going to be nothing beyond. And what'd they find? Lots more of the same. Galaxies, quasars, other celestial entities out there. And they've never seen the edge. So now they're going to say, oh, now this next telescope. But the point is that every time they build a bigger telescope, they just see more. And then they go, oh, well, we have to revise the age of the universe a little bit, and they tweak a number, and they say, well, the universe is now 15 billion years old instead of 13, and life goes on as usual. And they never realize that, no, this universe is infinite in extent. And these are concepts that people, average people, including myself, cannot really get a real grasp on. But this should tell you that even though you look farther out to places you've never seen before, that the carbon atom out there is the same as the one here on planet Earth. There's tremendous organization, tremendous order in the universe, and it's incredible. I mean, it certainly existed far back into the past as far as we can see, and yes, don't believe this Big Bang baloney. There is no evidence for a Big Bang. They claim this, but the pillars of the Big Bang, which is the redshift, it's not due to things moving away at near the speed of light in an expanding universe. It's due to the fusion process and a process that I discovered is called the induced electric dipole redshift, and it's local conditions around celestial objects that give you the redshift. not due to expanding. So the pillar of the redshift goes away. Then also the microwave background radiation is a microwave radiation that whenever they send up a telescope into outer space, microwave, looking at microwaves, they can see in all directions microwaves. But what that is it's a cloud of gas and dust that surrounds our solar system. That's all they're seeing. So if you got a telescope outside of that dust cloud, you would no longer see in all directions the microwave background radiation. And we see these clouds around other nearby stars. We see them. And with the microwave radiation signature. And these guys can't put one and one together. So the two major pillars of the Big Bang don't exist. It's garbage science. But they keep doing that because in standard science, if they keep saying the same thing, they keep getting a paycheck and life goes on. Anyway, back to the Christmas star. I was kind of getting away from the main topic there. But the Christmas star was a comet. No question about it. It has all the characteristics of a comet, including a big tail. And the other thing that's very characteristic of comets is they can have these big, bright spikes. But then you ask yourself, well, what was so unusual about this Christmas comet that set it apart from all other comets? Because there's to observers of the sky, like the three wise men, they would have seen dozens of comets per year in the night sky in the desert where you have clear visibility. They would have seen many comets per year. So what made this comet special? And I give some examples because now we know there are comets that have companions. Hale-Bopp was a comet that came into the solar system. It was visible for a period of 6 years, and it had a companion. And so what if a comet had two companions that were very visible, or a very set orbit? In other words, the period of the orbiting two objects, so three total, was very characteristic. And these guys would have seen that, and they said, that's it. There's the comet we've been looking for. The history that goes back thousands of years that they were looking at. And they individually, this is the amazing thing about the Christmas story, is individually, these guys didn't have telecommunications or cell phones. Remember, they didn't have satellite links to talk to each other. They individually, three of them, got together, packed all their stuff, and brought a royalty value gift of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which were, by the way, these things were very instrumental in Christ's development because they had gold, and which meant that they weren't poor. They had these gifts that were brought to them when the baby was born, and of course they kept them. And remember, they had to go to Egypt. They had to get out of Dodge. When the three kings found the baby, they had talked to Herod. Herod said, yeah, if you find the baby, come back and tell me. And they didn't like Herod. They knew something. They didn't trust him. So when they returned to their homelands, they went by a different route, and they didn't go back and talk to Herod. They didn't cross his territory. They actually went around. They went way out of their way, so they didn't have to talk to Herod. But Herod knew that something was up, that a baby had been born that would rival his power. So he sent out an edict to have all the firstborn males killed in the whole area, and they did. And the story is the angel came and told Joseph, hey, pack your bags and get out of here. And they fled into the night, into Egypt, where they stayed. And, of course, they had the gold. And they kept the gold, the frankincense, and the myrrh. And those were during the Christ's teaching years, after he was 30, from about 30 to 33 years old, those were instrumental in his life. And at the crucifixion, some of them even showed up. And so anyway, the birth of Christ was a monumental day in history and still celebrated. Our calendar is based on the birth of Christ and thousands of years of tradition. But one of the main key stories of this whole event is the three kings, the three magi coming from the east, discovering the star in the east. And why didn't they go eastward? Well, because the comet went by the sun, which is characteristic of comets. We had a comet that just did this. Comet Leonard C2021A1 is its designation. And it was a morning comet in the eastern sky for a time. And then on December, I think it was about December 4th, I don't know the exact date exactly, but around then, it crossed behind the sun, or actually between us and the sun, and became an evening comet, and now is visible in the western sky. So it was the exact same thing. It was discovered in the east. They followed it to the west. So this is a comet, no question about it. So Christmas time is a very good time to discuss these issues. And the statistics, what is the, I mean, there weren't one, it wasn't one king. If it was one king, you'd say, ah, you know, no big deal. Two kings, you'd say, well, that's a pretty big coincidence. But three kings, this is not a coincidence. This is the, and these guys were waiting. The tradition, remember, you go all the way back to Moses, when the Israelites were taken out of Egypt by Moses. There was a promise, there was an edict that God would send a Savior, a Messiah. And they had been waiting, and that was, our estimate is that was about 1500 BC when Moses left Egypt with the Israelites, crossed the Red Sea, and wandered in the desert for 40 years, and eventually ended up in Northern Europe and populating the Scandinavia, the Vikings. My ancestors were descendants of those original Israelites, where they settled in Northern Europe, in Ireland, and in the English Isles, the original people of the English Isles, in the three Scandinavian countries in Northern Europe, where they settled. And the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, those are the Israelites. But back to my point is that the promise of the Messiah was handed down from generation to generation to generation. And in that promise was a designation. When it happens, you're going to see something special in the sky. And it was very specific about a comet. And you'll also find in Christ's teachings, if you find the what they call the end days prophecies, the sermons that Christ gave when he was at the very end of his teaching, and the people said, well, what do we look for in the end days? He said, well, you're going to look up in the heavens and you're going to see signs in the heavens. You'll see meteor streams. Basically, he said the firmament will be shaken, which means a comet coming near Earth. And the meteor streams, the brimstone and fire, and the moon will seem to turn to blood, which is another characteristic of the comet passing by. So in very definitely, it's signs in the heavens. But the promise of the Messiah was a promise also in the heavens. And these three guys were astronomers. They lived out in the desert, very dry desert in the east, in the far east. And they saw this sign, which was the thing that they had been waiting for thousands of, well, not them personally, of course, for thousands of years, but the generations had been looking for this sign. And when they saw it, they all three recognized it. And Herod recognized it. His astronomers came to him and said, hey, this is the sign. This is the sign that means a Messiah is being born. And this is all history. This is all history. And Herod was so shaken by this. And then when the three wise men show up, and they go, yeah, we're following that star up there. That's the Messiah star. That means that the baby king that's going to rule the world is being born right now. And Herod says, well, when you find him, come back and tell me where you find him, okay? And so anyway, of course, the three kings didn't trust him and went a different route on the way back. But Herod realized that his power was at stake and sent out his fleet of bad guys to kill all the firstborn in the land, which they did. And of course, Joseph got the signal there from the angel, came and says, hey, you got to get out of Dodge, buddy. This is going down, and you got to save this baby. So they took the baby and in the middle of the night fled to Egypt, where they hung out for a long time, many years. And that's very instrumental in Christ's development, as he was educated in Egypt as a young person. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to stop there, but that's an essential part of the Christmas story, is dealing with comets. And tonight I'll be talking about comets a bit more also. And I just have so many topics, I'll have to divert some of these until next week. But I've been talking for the last number of weeks about a very special comet. It's called Comet Leonard. And this comet was very special in that it came extremely close to the planet Venus. And as I said, now this would be, in any other world or planet or universe, an extremely rare astronomical event. Imagine a naked eye comet. In other words, you can see this comet with the naked eye near the orbit of Venus. This is far away. This is not nearby. And this comet is big enough where you could see it with the naked eye. And I know people that saw it with their naked eye. In other words, no optical assistance, no binoculars, no telescopes, etc. This was discovered earlier this year in January. In fact, it's the first designated comet discovered in 2021. It's called 2021 A1. A1, it's the first one. And it was discovered by an automated search by an astronomer named Gregory Leonard, who, by the way, I wrote to twice. Not once, but twice. And I said, now the event where this is going to intersect the orbit with Venus, in other words, the comet's going to come very close to the planet Venus, on December 17th, which is last Friday night, and I want you to send me the pictures that you take with your telescope. Now, you're the discoverer of this comet. You have access to a world-class telescopic facility that you use to discover the comet, which is publicly funded, I guarantee you. I said, I want to see the photos. I never heard back. This is how dishonest the astronomical community is. This is how absolutely dishonest, and Gregory Leonard, using equipment that you paid for and I paid for, is keeping the photos from us seeing them, and a public release of the photos that shows the interaction. And very clearly there would have been just fireworks between this comet and the planet Venus. And by the way, it turns out that the original estimate of the close approach of this comet nucleus to Venus was 2.6 million miles. That's about 10 lunar distances. That's 10 times the distance from Earth to the moon, which is quite a bit. But even at that distance, there should have been electrical interaction using my plasma discharge comet model, not the silly, dirty snowball comet model, which is just, it's more than silly. It's sillier than silly. But anyway, these astronomers have to subscribe to that ridiculous theory because their paycheck depends on it. So anyway, the reality, however, is that according to space.com, which would they lie? And by the way, which when the space.com published an article after the Venus flyby, they talked about it, and it's just very spurious, it kind of happened. They posted a photo from December 4th. Now, this is on December 17th. The closest approach happens. Space.com publishes an article, and they use a photo from December 4th. Excuse me? They have a picture of the comet from December 4th. 2 weeks, literally 2 weeks before the close encounter. Is that the best they could do? Space.com couldn't find a photo of the comet at Venus? Do you see the problem here, folks? And on any of the places where photos are listed from amateurs, all of the pictures of that close encounter of the comet with Venus are scrubbed. They're not there. Not a single photo exists in the public eye of the comet passing Venus. And it turns out that according to space.com, it was only 31,000 miles. In other words, this 2.6 million mile estimate of the closest approach distance was off by a factor of 100. Now, any astronomer worth their salt could not make that mistake. I mean, that is an astronomically huge mistake. Was it a mistake? Are they that stupid? You know, is somebody lying? Is somebody, none of this adds up. But what adds up is that they did not want the public to see this comet as its closest approach to Venus. At 31,000 miles, that's like a geosynchronous orbit from Earth. And that would mean that Venus was completely engulfed in the coma, the small coma of the comet. And there are no pictures. No professional pictures. Do you think the Hubble Space Telescope was busy snapping photos of this event? Of course. Of course it was. And for this whole series of events leading up to this, watching when the comet first interacted with Venus, the Venus interaction, the closest approach, the what happened with Venus as the comet pulled away, not a single photo is available to the public. Now, I've done this before. I've had Freedom of Information Acts. I've had scientific requests for data. And they come back and they say, well, the data is only available to the principal investigators. That's their excuse. But you paid for this, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, moms and pops, and everybody else. You have paid for this, and they're not showing it. This is criminal. Now, I sent a second email to Gregory Leonard, sits in his nice chair in his University of Arizona office, paid for by you, paid by, you know, in his salary, in his nice, gorgeous, professional-grade astronomical equipment, paid for by you. You know, he didn't pay for it. He's getting all the credit and the glory. He discovered the comet. But when it comes down to this comet, I'm sure when he discovered this, he didn't know it was going to come close to Venus, at least right away. That usually takes a little bit of time. Maybe he did. But don't you think that he was there busy snapping photos as the most rare astronomical event in over 4,000 years occurred? Now, just to understand this, imagine a comet. Now, when we talk about asteroids coming near Earth, it might be a few lunar distances away. That's something that gets published in the press. The press, ooh, an asteroid's coming near Earth. You know, here we're talking about an eye-visible comet, a big comet. This is not big, 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 but it's big enough you can see it with the naked eye. That's pretty big, bright, because most comets last a day or two. And they're visible only with good equipment. Okay, they come zipping through the solar system, they're gone. This thing has been visible for now better part of a month or two, at least with minor amateur equipment. And now it's visible to the naked eye, and it has passed Venus, and it's still approaching the sun. It's still on its path inwards. It's not going to reach its perihelion until January 3rd, so it's getting brighter and brighter and brighter and more active. And there's nothing published. I mean, okay, let's put this into perspective. About 4,000 years ago, there was a comet that the ancients reported had an intersection of its orbit with the planet Mars. And they describe in detail that interaction. Okay, the ancients, this is in all of the history books around the world, all of the cultures describe this. That is the last time in the history of the human race that a comet came close to a planet. So here we are in 2021, December, Christmas, which, you know, talking about Christmas stars and Christmas comets and things like that. Here's the astronomical event that has not happened for over 4,000 years in the history of the human race, and not a single photo. Not a single photo exists of this. Not from professionals, not from amateurs where they're posting on the internet. It has been completely scrubbed. This is hardly even possible. Because let's take another example here, a minor comet. A minor comet that is not even naked eye visible. You will have thousands of photos posted on the internet from amateurs. They have their own homepage. They have their own, they have common places where they post photos, etc. They have other places that will go out and search for photos and put them on their page. So this is like a dumping ground for photos of comets. And there's thousands of amateur astronomers with really good, almost professional equipment around the world. And do you know that there is not one photo of this comet near Venus? That's not even possible. Do you understand the magnitude of this discrepancy in the history of reporting of comets? And it's the most important astronomical event in 4,000 years in terms of observation. There have been other major astronomical events, but I'm not going to go into them now. But I sent a second email to Gregory Leonard, sitting in his nice chair at the University of Arizona. And by the way, I've had problems with University of Arizona people before. It's a Jesuit-owned institution and linked to the New World Order, etc. So they're very locked in. And I sent him a second email. And it was very simple. It simply said, are you going to release the photos that you're taking of the Venus crossing event with Comet Leonard? You're at Comet, the one you discovered, you know, so you know about it. I didn't say that, but of course he knows about it. I said, are you going to release the photos you're going to take or not? I said, this is a yes or no question. And I said, silence is not an option. Say yes, and then release them, or say no, you're not going to release them. It's a yes or no question. Very simple. I never heard back. In fact, you can find his email address on the website, University of Arizona, Gregory Leonard. Look it up. There's his email, and say, write to him. Give him an email. Give him a piece of your mind and say, hey, I paid for this grandiose equipment that your lousy behind is using, and I want to see the photos. And Mr. McCanny wants to see them because he's a professional and he can interpret them. And no photoshopping or doctoring of the photos, please. Thank you very much. And if you're not going to send them, I want to know why you're not releasing to me, the public, that's paying for your lousy behind and your equipment that's glorioso astronomically, some of the best equipment in the world, why you're keeping this information from the public. Because very clearly, I will tell you, I guarantee you 100 and 197%, they took photos and they saw interactions and they don't know what to do about it. Very clearly. Okay? So I'm going to jump off that bandwagon for a minute, but this is just to show you the absolute corrupt, dishonest level. And I'm going to repeat his name, Gregory Leonard, University of Arizona. You know, and it's a form of lying. It's a form of professional lying. And not only that, but this is the public trust. His lousy behind is there in that chair because of your money, not because he's some kind of smart person. I could be there in a position like that, but I don't work for those people. I don't want anything to do with them because they are dishonest, because they work for somebody else. And I want to tell you a little story. I got a listener that interacted with me quite a few emails here about the Comet Leonard issue. And this person wrote in and said that this person had an interaction with three professional astronomers. And they were like people that he knew and talked to at an observatory. And so anyway, none of them would talk. This is back in the Hale-Bopp days, which, of course, is a whole other story about corruption, astronomical incompetence, astronomical malfeasance, and basically hiding data, etc. And by the way, I mentioned earlier that that Hale-Bopp had a companion, and there's a big controversy over that. Publicly, they say there wasn't, but at the Canary Island conference on Hale-Bopp, which was an international conference, the very first topic on the docket was the companion of Hale-Bopp. They all knew, all the astronomers knew, that Hale-Bopp had a companion. And in the public, they denied it. Anyway, that's another whole story of corrupt astronomical reporting and twisting stories for the news media when in the background they're doing something else. Okay, so back to my story here of the listener writing in, conversing back and forth about this comet Leonard and the bizarre, I mean, this guy is looking too. He's spending his time looking for photos on the internet of this event. Cannot find them. Okay, so anyway, he tells me the fact that he had been communicating, this is a while back, with, I think he said during the Hale-Bopp days, with three professional astronomers. And so he said he took one of them out for supper one night, and they were talking, and he bought him a few martinis, so he got him kind of, you know, loosened up a little bit at the jaw and to try and get some information out of him. And he's after a while, you know, he was trying to beat around the bush and ask questions. And finally he said, why don't you people talk about this? And the guy clearly was scared, he said. And he said, look, I got a family. That was the astronomer's reply to him trying to ask about the comet Hale-Bopp and what was really going on. And so what they do is they got these guys scared. So imagine, here I'll just give you the life cycle of an astronomer. They go to school, they're all excited, they want to be an astronomer, they go to the undergrad, they take chemistry and physics 101, because most astronomers don't have hardly any physics at all. They're very poor in terms of physics and mathematics. You know, they have kind of a smattering of it, but they're not, they should have a lot more physics. And so at any rate, the average astronomer, then he goes to grad school. Now he gets completely indoctrinated with complete garbage, Big Bang, dirty snowball, you know, fusion at the center of the sun, all of the standard garbage that isn't true. It could not possibly be true, but they've learned the ropes. They have to regurgitate what their professor tells them. Then they get an A, then they go on. And now let me explain something about getting a PhD, is that in a lot of cases, there's some rigorous aspects to it, of course. But the biggest thing when it comes to astronomy is that the theoretical part, the so-called theoretical structure, you simply repeat it like a Pavlov's dog. And if you do that, you get an A, you get your degree, and then you get your first postdoc. Okay, now you're hungry. You're testing the waters out there. You might get on some papers that somebody's publishing, and there's a list of 10 names, and you get your name to be on the very last person because you're a postdoc, or maybe even a grad student. Okay, and if you're lucky, if you're really lucky, you might even get a published paper on some baloney, like there's some going on right now about Comet Leonard, and the fact that it may have had an asteroid or a meteor shower at Venus. Like, how absolutely ridiculous. They're talking about an asteroid shower at Venus when there's all of these electrical interactions going on. I mean, boys and girls, what a bunch of buffoons. I mean, do these people really sleep at night? And, you know, anyway. The whole issue here, okay, back to the graduate student, okay, he gets his postdoc, now he gets his first position, and he's thoroughly indoctrinated with the whole issue of complying. Because there's a pecking order, and if this student now very young. He might be teaching an astronomy in the undergraduate astronomy at the university level or something like that. If this guy makes one little cross, like, hey, do you think this dirty snowball comet model is really true? It doesn't make any sense. It has all kinds of contradictions. It doesn't explain the data we see. We're always trying to find Band-Aids to patch it up when we find new data. And, you know, if that person said one thing like that, they would be demoted, they would be ostracized, they would be, the pecking order would come down on them so hard. When I was at Cornell University, I went around campus and I talked to the different departments. And I had an appointment with a guy in the geology department who was a young pre-tenure professor there. And so I had an appointment with him, and I came into the secretary's office, and of course, all the people at Cornell knew me very well as a thorn in their side. I came into the office, and I said to the secretary, I have an appointment to see somebody. And out of the adjacent office was the chairman of the department, who is one of Carl Sagan's good buddies, screams out, if anybody in this department talks to McCanny, they won't receive tenure. That's what the guy screamed. And of course, nobody came out to greet me. The guy wanted tenure. The guy wanted his tenure. So he got bought. He got cornered. He got religion, as they called it, and understood where his role in life was. I went into the department chairman of the new department at the time of archaeoastronomy, which means the combination of archaeology and astronomy. And I talked to the chairman of the department, and he stood up and he shook my hand. And he said, I see everything you're doing, but I can't talk about anything or I'll lose my job. I'll lose my department, because archaeoastronomy was a new department, a recognized field of study, taking archaeological sites and studying them in terms of our astronomy, astronomical positioning and things like that. What did the ancients who built these archaeological structures know about astronomy, and how did it influence their architecture, etc.? That was what he was. But he stood up and he said, Mr. McCanny, he said, I respect what you're doing, but I can't say a word, because I would lose my tenure, I would lose my department if I supported you. That's what's going on, folks. So Gregory Leonard, I'm going to write him an email, and I'm going to tell him, listen to this show, and you're bought, you're paid for, sit in your little office in Arizona, collect your paycheck, go golf, I'm sure you're a good golfer, you know, and examine your life. What are you doing? Are you really, you want to be known, go down in history as just another astronomer who bought the party line, collected your paycheck, hid the data, and didn't release it using publicly funded facilities? Yeah, but see, you're at a Jesuit-run university. You better march the party line, or you're going to be out on your ear. And where's an astronomer like you going to find another job? You know, you're not. You know, running a few McDonald's stands. So at any rate, you know, this gets down in the mud, and it's really not what astronomy should be all about. It should be about advancements, etc., but it's not. It's all politically motivated. Okay, now I want to jump onto a topic here, because recently, and this is when we're dealing with Christmas coming up, etc. Now, I want to make a distinction here between religion and, say, theosophy, the study of God, etc. There's a big difference, because religions are organized efforts religion, that's the term, to be religious or dedicated to a belief, a series of beliefs. And typically, they're very well organized, and in say, the Catholics, the Muslims, the Buddhists, and you go right down the list of some of the major religions of the world, they have a set of rules, kind of like human beings are great at setting up rule books and lists of things that you should do and not do. And usually this is based on natural law and natural order. And then there's people who do not have religions. And it's interesting that religions are also used to control because, for example, when John Lennon started, he was living in New York City, you know, he had Beatles career, he was living with Ono, his wife, and I think his son was living with him then. But he came out with he had been silent for a long time. Paul McCartney went on to his singing about happy songs, and Paul created other groups with his wife, Linda. But John Lennon went silent for a while, and all of a sudden he comes out with this song, Imagine. Imagine all the people, and he goes, what if the world, you know, had no structure, no government, and no religions too? And you think, well, wait a minute, no religions. Religion should be kind of the backbone of ethics and things like that, but they're really not. They're really used for control, and they always have been. Whenever you've had a major religion, such as Christianity, I wouldn't call Christianity a religion. It's more of a sect. And within Christianity, you have the primary one, which historically was the first one, was the Catholic Church, which grew out of the Middle Ages and the papacy, etc., Rome, the center of the Catholic Church. And the other religions actually kind of grew out of that. But it was the Christ teachings which were solidified into the Catholic Church, and then it became overtaken by the Jesuits and the front agency, the Rothschild Bank, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, etc., and what's called the Holy See, S-E-E, interestingly enough, which oversees it's like the all-seeing eye on the top of the pyramid of the dollar bill, you know, the triangle and the eye up there. That's the all-seeing eye, or the Holy See. And that's connected into the New World Order, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Rothschild Banking, International Banking Cartel, which is the front agency for the Vatican Bank. And I talk about this. Where did they get their money? Well, primarily in the Middle Ages, when after the Columbus discovery of the New World and all of that amazing amount of wealth that came across the ocean back to the Spain and England and Portugal and the other countries that were involved in that also. All of that wealth came back to the Catholic Church. So they got this amazing influx of gold, which was it's still there today, and gives the basis for the Queen of England. Like, you know, the prince just died in England, and he had been there for, you know, what, he was 98 years old. And so he had been the primary ruler of England, along with the Queen, who is the Queen of England, but she's a Rothschild. She's a German. She was not born in England. They arranged that marriage, and Prince Philip, I believe was his name, was the actual person from England, but she married him to become the queen. And she's a Rothschild from Germany. Go check it out. You know, she went through two world wars. I mean, that's amazing. And she's still there. But anyway, that's the power structure of the world. And so back to the idea of religions. Religion is something different, but the idea of the belief in God, a designer, a creator, this design plan that is kind of the Native Americans and a lot of the indigenous peoples, or the Peruvians, is it Pachamama? I think that's the Peruvian term. I should know. I spent a lot of time there. But anyway, that is kind of the natural belief that there is a higher entity and that we're just part of this, and we've been given a gift of this life, and we're on this planet. And there are some certain natural things. For example, let me give you an example. A liar, or a person who covers up for his own personal gain, like somebody like Gregory Leonard. You know, or it could be people that do big crimes like the Clintons or somebody. But they always put on this face of being wonderful and nice and everything. And the reason they do that is because they know that they have to fool people into them, the people thinking that they're wonderful people. And so there's this, even amongst thieves and liars, there's kind of a code of ethics that's written in them, and they're devious enough to know that they got to fool you into thinking they're a great person. And so the excuse me, I don't mean to compare Leonard with the Clintons. That's not a good comparison. Each one is devious in their own world. Let's just put it that way. The Clintons on a scale that is unmatched by very few people in history, and so at any rate, but it's something that's ingrained in your being. And of course, science today wants to teach you that. You are just a smarter monkey than the ones out there in the jungle, that you evolved from the monkey, and that's it. When you die, you go away. There's no soul. There's no spirit. There's no necessity to be honest, and your gain here on Earth is your ultimate reward, etc. And they completely negate the idea of recognizing a grand creator, a God, whatever you want to call this entity that permeates the universe. And a universe that is so infinite in extent, in time in the past and time in the future, that we can't comprehend it. We can't even comprehend the number line going out to infinity. We have little rules like induction and other rules of mathematics that allow us to understand the concept of infinity. But if you start walking down a number line, I don't care how far you walk, it's still a small number, or how big a prime number you calculate with a supercomputer, it's still a teeny, teeny number. No matter how many powers of 10 and digits that you put in your newly found prime number, it's teeny. It's teeny, weeny, weeny. And so that's the whole issue of the universe. And so anyway, the reason I'm going through this kind of a dialogue is because lately in the press, and I don't know why that's going on, I think it has part of the thing to do with the fact that they are trying to push the UFO alien issue now as a control mechanism, of course. But there's so many references to God is not necessary. Science has proven that there's no God. And even there are some articles that say science proves that there is a God, and then you go and read the article, think that supports your case. And it, ultimately, the article starts talking about how science doesn't need God. There's no need for grand design. The Big Bang happened. It just happened spontaneously. And they believe that's been proven. Ultimately, as I said earlier, the two main pillars of the Big Bang simply don't even exist. They're bad. They're misinterpretation of data. And they've gone on for 100 years now with misinterpretation of data. And trying to support some idea that's completely bogus for 100 other reasons. Okay, but anyway, recently, they have been pumping this idea that God is not necessary, that science, all-knowing science, shows that the universe is naturally occurring, that, you know, and it's exactly the thing that should convince you that there is a divine, you know, something that we can't understand. And, you know, the whole issue here is that, you know, and I heard, here's a question that came up, and a guy wrote in, and it's a legitimate question, that if the universe is planned and is so organized, and God knows everything that's going to happen, everything that has happened, and knows all about you and everything that you're going to do in your lifetime, then you don't have any free will. This is a very old argument. I mean, we discussed this in college. I went to a four-year private Catholic Christian college, all male, and a very strict. But this question comes up to anybody that's got half a brain. They're going to think of this question. But here's the answer. Here's the answer. It's like, let's take the three wise men on their return trip. They chose not to go back where Herod was. They chose to go around. It was a choice. And this is a good example. If you put your hand on the table or desk in front of you and you say, on the count of three, I'm going to raise my hand. And you go one, two, three, and then you go, well, wait, I think I'm going to count to six and then raise my hand. Okay, one, two, three, four, five, six. Now you raise your hand. That was a planned choice. Now, let's look at the sun or the planet Earth or a hurricane. It doesn't have a choice. A hurricane doesn't have a choice of saying, well, I'm going to turn a little bit north over here. No, it has physical principles that guide it. And if you could get a computer that could put all of the atoms and all of the information in the universe into a massive computer And you could calculate the past, and you could calculate the future, and everything that's going to happen in the physical universe, but man is different. Man is the only animal or plant in living that has a free choice. Animals don't have a free choice. They are responding to their environment, okay? They're just like a plant is responding to its environment. And it would be a very difficult calculation if you included all the biological life on Earth in your supercomputer calculation, but man is different. Man has a free choice. They make decisions for good, for bad, for their own protection, for their own self-preservation. The Gregory Leonards of the world who hide information that should be publicly available because of their own whatever decision, because somebody up or higher isn't going to let them let the data out or whatever. But man has a choice. And so we have a choice. I made a physical choice when I never wanted to work for the government. I never wanted to sign an agreement with the government or with universities. I've always been an independent scientist. And I'm very happy I did, because I can be honest. I can be honest with me, with you. I can be honest, and I can tell you what's going on, etc. But this is, but the answer to that question, and very important at Christmas time, is that man has a free choice. And so that the entire universe, except for man, is structured, and the sun is going to do what it's going to do today, tomorrow, and if you had enough calculation, you could predict what the sun is going to do tomorrow. And some of the theories about the sun are very incorrect, so they can't predict. But if you had a perfectly 100% correct theory of the entire universe, you could predict what everything is going to do, except for man, because man has a free choice. And that's the whole issue here, is because of all the matter in the universe, only a very, very, very small amount is dedicated to the thing we call the human species, or intelligent life, if you go out into the universe. Intelligent life, and that's because you can make a choice. And one of the biggest choices you should be making is to look around and look at everything around you and thank your creator for your life. It says, they say that the angels are jealous of man because we have a body. We have something very special, and you better use this gift you've been given. Stop looking at that cell phone and looking at YouTube videos and start living your life like a real meaningful life. And that's my Christmas message to you, is to wake up, start living your life, start living an honest life as a Christian, because in a sense, everybody in the world are Christians, whether they like it or not. This is Jim McCanney, and once again, I wish you a very Merry Christmas, Happy New Year's. It's been wonderful this year, looking forward to a big year next year in all respects. And remember my webpage, jmccsci.com, and the water filter page, jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.